This is Scenic Roots. I'm Ray Bassett. Thanks for joining us. Have you heard of permaculture? If you visit Crabtree Farms in Chattanooga this weekend, you can learn all about it in a workshop titled Introduction to Permaculture Design on Saturday from 1:30 to 3:30 p.m. Sarah McIntyre is executive director of Crabtree Farms. Nathaniel Bankhead is a farmer there and co-owner of Wild Violet Permaculture. Sarah, Nathaniel, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Introduction to Permaculture Design. How did we come up with this class?
I believe we came up with this class because Nathaniel is a member of our staff and he is exquisitely talented and interested in implementing permaculture design both at Crabtree Farms and elsewhere in the wide world.
That's a generous description of what's going on.
And when we say permaculture design, what are we talking about?
That is a huge, huge question. It's a system of agricultural design that a man named Bill Mollison came up with several decades ago in Tasmania and Australia. And it is using three ethics to guide a design process. And those are care of the earth, care of people, and reinvesting surplus into those first two.
And what's an example that we might see of that either at Crabtree Farms or elsewhere?
A thing that's gaining ground in the agricultural community is the thing called agroforestry. And there's a permaculture principle called integrate rather than segregate. So traditional agriculture, you would probably see a pasture dedicated to cattle, and cattle are the only thing happening in that field. And then a few hundred yards down the way, you'd have an orchard, and fruit crops are the only thing going on there. And then you have your garden. So permaculture design enables us to take the fertilization potential that cattle provide in a pasture system and integrate that with fruit crops and with annuals. So you would see rows of trees and then alleyways of grass. And then underneath the trees, you can grow shrub crops, vining crops, and annual crops that are self-sowing with animals grazing in the alleys.
And how do you achieve that?
A lot of time. A lot of observation of what the native ecology is trying to do to begin with, and then protracted action and reflection on the feedback that you're getting from nature.
And then what will people be learning about to start that process?
At this workshop this weekend? So there is a book that recently came out called Retro Suburbia. And it's by one of the co-founders of permaculture down in Australia. And the idea is basically in the suburbs, which is where most of the people participating in the workshop are going to be, there are financial, human, and natural resources flowing across properties. So we're just posing the question, how can we best capture, utilize, and recycle all of what's already happening on your property? You've got sunlight, wind, water, people, money, and plants. Already active, how can we organize that in a way that creates abundance for us and also heals the land?
And this area is probably particularly suited for this type of workshop because of all the biodiversity we have around here in Chattanooga and the Tennessee Valley.
It really is. We're just a couple hours from one of the richest spots for biodiversity on the planet in the Great Smoky Mountains, and we're just their slightly less developed cousin down here.
Indeed. And in fact, we are already in the watershed of the most biodiverse space.
And is this brand new for Crabtree Farms, or is this a recent ongoing effort?
I would say that Crabtree has been interested in permaculture for a long time. It's not how our farm was designed originally. And efforts to that end have been somewhat stilted. Partly because our farmers tend to come to us without a lot of foreknowledge of agriculture. You know, Nathaniel's distinct and different in that he comes with a rich history of agriculture. And so a lot of people come and they learn to farm at Crabtree. And in learning to farm at Crabtree, you learn our sustainable methods, which are a cousin of permaculture, but we're the cousin that focuses more on production, whereas permaculture, the emphasis is less on production, especially at the beginning. At the end, the argument is that they can be just as, if not more so, productive as kind of your typical row cropping sustainable agriculture farm.
So I imagine that you've gotten quite a few queries from people, especially regulars there at Crabtree Farms, about how much is this like what you already have and what you've already taught us, and how much of this is something totally different?
Absolutely. And to that we say, same, same, different. There are aspects and philosophies that I think that we hold and share, and then it's the application of those that is really quite different and unique, and that people can really begin to think about their yards, their communities, as Nathaniel said, about suburbia in a completely different way. So it's taking, if you come traditionally to Crabtree and you learn about gardening, you're going to learn about how do you garden in your backyard for you and maybe sharing with neighbors. You're going to look at it less as what is my yard as a patch and a quilt. And Nathaniel's going to speak more of, let's look at this quilt and let's all be patches in the quilt, rather than let's each have a box and look at it separate and distinct from something else. So we tend to approach agriculture from a discrete perspective. And I think Nathaniel in permaculture is really trying to approach it from a continuous perspective. Does that ring true for you, Nathaniel?
Yeah. Yeah, you can't see one property in isolation. Just like any of the people that come through Crabtree aren't existing on an island. It's a remarkable place for how much diversity of perspective Crabtree brings in. So we're looking at that as an asset, I'd say, rather than, oh goodness, look at all that we have to work with. So in the same way, Crabtree can't grow everything. No local farm in the area can do it all. Mm-hmm. But if we can step back and observe, hey, you're doing this one particular thing really, really well. Mm-hmm. How do we capitalize on that to benefit the dozen or so other farms that we are in some way partnered with?
Mm-hmm. And I think it also speaks to where do you start and how do you begin a transition process? Just like there are many farms right now that are transitioning from kind of the agribusiness, conventional method of farming, moving towards sustainability. And so what can Crabtree, how can we begin to move in the direction of something even more sustainable than what we do now? So we've had people in the past who have practiced hugelkultur in our blueberries. And
hugelkultur?
Yeah. You want to speak more on that, Nathaniel?
Yeah, it's hugel, not hugelkultur.
Hugel. Well, I have it spelled in my brain as H-U-G-E-L. So in my brain, it's like hugelkultur.
Just clarifying for all the normal listeners.
All the non-Kansans out there.
Hugelkultur is, I assume it originated in Germany.
It sounds like it.
It is, at its most simplest form, it's you take a hunk of wood, which is carbon, which is what comprises the organic matter in your soil, and you bury it. And you let all of the microbiology that's in the soil break that down. So you're kind of creating a safety deposit box for organic matter in the future. And you can, if you have to drop a tree when you're installing a garden, you can take that wood and rather than shipping it or having it hauled off, you bury it beside the garden and you plant whatever it is you want to grow on top of that and let nature do the breakdown. Mm-hmm. And then we reap the benefit of that soil health decades into the future. Mm-hmm. So that's just one little example of, hey, this is a waste, traditionally viewed as a waste. How do we turn that into a resource?
What got you into permaculture?
That is also a long story. The founder of permaculture, his name was Bill Mollison, grew up in Tasmania, moved to Australia, and was observing the way indigenous communities didn't exhaust the natural resources on their land in the same way that industrial farming was doing. And I, similarly, but by a very different path, had some interaction with indigenous peoples in the West. And that led to me meeting a career permaculture trainer who basically said, this is the way we do our farming. And it resonated very deeply with me.
And something that you hope will start to resonate here in Chattanooga and the Tennessee Valley.
Absolutely. I think there's space for a diversity of thought and approach to how we think about our land and how we treat it, as long as the base of all of those is respect and an eye toward future and sustainability. And so, you know, whether it be through kind of our way of doing sustainable agriculture or permaculture or biodynamics or regenerative agriculture. There's a lot of different approaches. And I think that kind of how you buy into any one of those is up to you and your land. And really, it's about thinking deeply about what is available to you, what your land can support. If you don't have land, I'm an unlanded person, right? I rent. And so how can I bring those tenants into the space that I'm resting lightly on in the world right now? And what can you support? How else can you support agriculture, even if you're not going to practice it yourself? I think the more we learn about how we interact with the earth and its resources and one another, the better able we are to make decisions and appreciate what others are doing, even if you can't do it yourself, or even if you can't support, you know, maybe you're not a person who can support buying local or buying organic at this moment in your life, but you can appreciate that and you can appreciate the space that it holds in the world and in the economy and ecologically. And so you can say, yes, I do these things because that's what my economics support, but my heart supports these things. I think there's room for a diversity of thought and idea there.
And where can people go online for more information?
Crabtreefarms.org. We have all of our workshops listed. Saturday's a big day, so there are definitely still spots available for Nathaniel's workshop on permaculture, which is happening this Saturday from 1:30 to 3:30 p.m. It's $40 or $35 if you have already paid a donation to Crabtree Farms this year. In addition, there will be Healing Salve that's happening also this Saturday, also led by a farmer. It's led by our own Courtney Parker. So she's going to come in the morning and she's going to do healing salve with people from 10 to 12:30. And then Nathaniel's going to kind of take over the Evelyn Center and he's going to rock people's world with permaculture later that afternoon. And then in the evening, Crabtree Farms is taking over Main Times 24. And there's a wild and bitter party happening at Wildflower Tea and Apothecary, which is another really great locally owned, mindful, rests lightly on the earth organization or business. Wildflower Tea and Apothecary is hosting a party and she's partnering with The Bitter Bottle. And Kalina Goldsworthy is a longtime volunteer of ours. She kind of became inspired to make her own bitters through her work at Crabtree, her volunteerism work at Crabtree with Mike. And she's inspired by cocktails. She's a career cocktailist, I guess, at this point. Mixologist, maybe, is what you call folks who do that. And then next Tuesday on December 10th, we're having a do-it-yourself ladies gift making night where all the upstairs ladies, of which I am one, are getting together. And we're basically having a big potluck and we're inviting all the ladies in town to come. You can self-identify. We're good. Just to make sure that everybody knows we're inclusive, non-binary there, that you can come and DIY. You'll be for $35, I think it is. You get to come and make 5 different do-it-yourself gifts and you take home the recipes and take home the ways to make those. So that way you can kind of do your own gift giving this holiday. And in addition, there's a small gift market that's other cottage industry ladies who live in Chattanooga are bringing their wares too. So we're all about getting together and sharing ideas of how to take care of one another in a variety of ways.
All right. Sarah, Nathaniel, thanks so much and all the best.
Thank you so much, Ray.
Thanks, Ray.
You can follow Nathaniel Bankhead online at wildviolettpermaculture.com. Also on Saturday, the Wahatchee Boulder Fest takes place at the foot of Lookout Mountain in Chattanooga's St. Elmo neighborhood. The fest celebrates the grand opening of the new climbing area at the Lookout Mountain Conservancy's Boulders on Old Wahatchee Pike. Climbers of all levels are welcome there from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. The Boulder Fest is hosted by the Access Fund and the Southeastern Climbers Coalition. Robin Carlton is CEO of the Lookout Mountain Conservancy, and Zachary Lesh-Huey is with the Access Fund. Robin, Zachary, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, happy to be here.
So tell us more about Boulder Fest.
Wahatchee Boulder Fest is an idea we put together to sort of celebrate this great new resource we have in Chattanooga, which Lookout Mountain Conservancy owns, and that's the boulders on Old Wahatchee Pike. And the Boulder Fest will be a gathering open to the climbing community and the public to come sample this new climbing area, try out rock climbing. If they want, they can do the bouldering competition as well that's going on that day.
And for folks who may be hearing about this for the first time, describe the scene for me.
So you're at the foot of Lookout Mountain, and hidden in there in some beautiful property that the Conservancy owns and manages are more than two dozen big sandstone blocks, car-sized boulders up to house-sized boulders. And for rock climbers, these rocks are what we're looking for. And this is what we do on the weekends. And so right there at the base of Lookout Mountain, you have this boulder field that's a great climbing area. And on the day of Boulder Fest, you'll have 50 to 100 climbers running around there, climbing on these rocks, supporting each other, having a good time.
And Robin, tell us more about how this all came together with the Lookout Mountain Conservancy and what Zachary and his folks do.
We have acquired 50 acres at the base of Lookout Mountain, and it's really quite historical property. And as we are really kind of looking at how to develop this park, we discovered that we had some really large rocks on it. And as we kept discovering this 50 acres, we discovered more rocks. And one day I was just walking through and I just kept going, wow, these are beautiful. But what's all that white stuff on there? I was kind of startled by it. And then all of a sudden it occurred to me, people are climbing on these rocks. Oh my goodness. From a risk management standpoint, they're not safe. Because we're talking about on the slope of a mountain, and as I could just see putting crash pads down, and one of these climbers hitting a crash pad and ending up in the Tennessee River. So trying to immediately figure out what it is that climbers need, and then from really kind of making it as safe as we can on the slope of a mountain, and making it fun. And just being able to use these boulders in a way that people really, really appreciate. And so that's been a very cool transformation for us to get into.
So how has this site been transformed to include all those things that you talked about?
We now have a trail system that connects all the boulders. And all of the boulders now have what we called landscaped bouldering pads around them. Some of them are really quite extensive, because you can't just put rock on top of rock. It's like putting together a puzzle. And we call it the walk test. Once we put down a layer of rock, if you walk on it and they wobble, you get to start all over again, because otherwise it won't stand the test of time.
And how does this compare to other climbing attractions in this area? And what would you say is unique about this one?
So it's a very similar resource to some other well-known bouldering spots in town. In fact, world-class areas, Stone Fort up near Soddy Daisy, Rocktown just there in northern Georgia. These are bouldering areas that folks from all the country and even the world travel to every year. And so this boulder field here at the base of Lookout Mountain is like those. It's similar, good quality Cumberland sandstone, good variety, something for all climbing ability levels. But what's especially unique about it is that it's right downtown. And so Chattanooga is now a well-known climbing town, but you're often driving 30 minutes to an hour or more to go to a climbing area. And that's pretty good. That's pretty convenient. But there's a lot of climbers living downtown, working downtown, have families downtown. And this is among the most accessible boulder fields out there for really any city in the country. The Wauhatchie boulders are really special in that they're super accessible, close to town, convenient. So you can go there on a lunch break, you can go there on a weekend. It's a really great resource for that.
Not only will there be plenty of climbing involved, but also this is going to be a benefit.
Right. A lot of our appreciation, all of our appreciation really goes to Lookout Mountain Conservancy. They're the folks charged with owning and managing this property, and also happens to have this special climbing resource. And the climbing community wants to have this wonderful event, but also make it supportive of Lookout Mountain Conservancy's long-term efforts to protect the area, and not just for climbing, but for everything that it offers.
One of the things that people often ask us is, do you charge for us to be out there? And the answer is no. We are a 501c3 nonprofit, which means basically everything that we have, when it's ready to be open to the public, it's for the public use. This is really a very unique area in the sense that Ohwehatchee Pike will connect to the last extension of the Riverwalk. And so that's going to be kind of added traffic coming our way. But also, too, the fact that once you get to this park, there's a pollinator garden, there's a teaching garden, there will be an amphitheater, and then you have these 27 boulders that actually this has become the first natural urban bouldering park in the Southeast, which, you know, is really kind of, we had no idea until somebody brought that to our attention. And we do, we have people come from all over the country to climb on these boulders. And I'm like, how did you hear from us? And this is a community that puts the internet to shame. They communicate and their network is very, very strong. And we're just happy to do it. We're happy to do it. We are a little bit different than a lot of your traditional land trusts. Most land trusts would never allow this type of recreation to happen on their property, because they really kind of look at the stone as being something natural and should be preserved, as well as we do. We've had some really kind of interesting moments with the climbing community, of us getting to know them and them getting to know us and what's important. There was a group of guys out one day and they had their brushes and they were just scrubbing down these rocks. And I was like, what are you doing? And they were like, well, this is dangerous to us. And I said, well, that's important to us, that moss has been there for a long, long time. And we know that when you are climbing, then it's going to come off, but we're not going to take it off right now. And, you know, it's just one of those moments in time where two different entities just kind of collided in a really wonderful way of really understanding conservation values.
Caring about the same thing, but in different ways from different angles.
Absolutely.
Yeah, Robin's speaking to a balance of conservation and recreation, and Access Fund, too, or National Climate Advocacy Group, also a conservation group, and we're an accredited land trust as well. And so conservation is woven into our work and mission, as well as obviously recreation. And so the project out at Ohwehatchee Boulder has been a great chance to balance those two things and really reach a management solution that kind of wins on all sides. And I think climbers have learned a lot through that. I certainly have, working with Robin. Yeah, all the values that you can have from a special conserved area are out there now, including a really awesome climbing area.
And where can people go online for more information?
Best bet is to go on Eventbrite and even register for the event. So look up Ohwehatchee Boulder Fest on Eventbrite. You can also find us on Access Fund's Facebook page. There's event info there. And I want to emphasize, this is an event that's open to everyone, even if you're brand new to climbing. It's a good chance to come out. There'll be climbing shoe vendors and other folks with the basics that you can try out gear and try out climbing. And just a lot of climbers out being the supportive community that we are. So encourage anyone and everyone to come out, from beginner all the way up to advanced.
And where can people go online for more information about the Conservancy, Robin?
Our Facebook page, as well as our website, lookoutmountainconservancy.org.
All right. Robin, Zachary, thanks so much and all the best.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to Scenic Roots. More after our news with Bill McLean. This is Scenic Roots. I'm Ray Bassett. Jennifer Farr Davis is a hiker, an author, and a National Geographic Adventurer of the Year. She lives in Asheville, North Carolina, and she has covered more than 14,000 miles of long-distance trails on six continents. Jennifer recently collaborated with watercolor artist Alan Shuptrine on the coffee table book I Come From a Place, paying tribute to the Appalachian Trail. We invited Jennifer back to Scenic Roots for a conversation about her own story. Jennifer, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
How did you first get into hiking?
Well, I grew up in the southern Appalachians, just outside of Asheville, but I really didn't do any hiking or backpacking or camping as a child or growing up. And then I graduated from college, and like a lot of 21-year-olds, I was trying to figure out the rest of my life and didn't know what to do. And I had always heard of the Appalachian Trail. So I scrounged up some backpacking gear and set off on my own from Georgia. And 5 months later, I reached Maine, and I was a completely different person. And I was so, so grateful for the experience and the education I received while hiking the trail. So it's been a part of me ever since.
And in 2011, you hiked the trail in 46 days, 11 hours, and 20 minutes.
Yeah, which is fast. It's the average of 47 miles a day, and that established the overall record for men and women on the trail, which was really cool. I was the first woman to set an overall record for both genders on any of these long trails in North America. But for me, it was not like a journey about speed or even being the best. It was just something to where, in so many ways, I feel like spending time outdoors has been liberating. Like, it's freed me and my mind, and there's so many categories or boxes or limitations that I had put myself in or put on myself, and going outdoors has just revealed that I'm capable of more than what I thought. And so going for this record was really me saying, because I used to think, oh, the guys are going to outperform the women, or, oh, my body may not be capable of doing this, or my mind might not be capable. But I always felt like I had a unique gift for hiking. So the intent was to go out and take away the limitations and take away the self-doubt and just see like what my body could do. And as you can see, the results were very impressive, but at the end of the day, it wasn't the results that mattered to me. It was the fact that I got to do the trail again, and it was a life-changing journey, and there were so many lessons that I learned along the way.
And you've also backpacked more than 700 miles in the second and third trimesters of pregnancy.
Yes. So most of that was with my daughter because she was my first child. And so my husband and I, we backpacked the length of the Pyrenees Mountains from the Mediterranean to the Atlantic, and did a shorter trail in Iceland and did other backpacking trips and day hikes. And I even guided. So I have a hiking company in Western North Carolina located near Asheville, North Carolina. And until I was 6 or 7 months pregnant, I was actively guiding trips too. And it was important to me. And you know, I think women can be very active and fit and spend time outdoors when they're pregnant, when they have young children. But personally, for me, it was very important because hormonally, I really struggled with depression during my pregnancy. And hiking was one of the best tools and the best medicines that I had to combat it. And I always felt better when I was on the trail. So I was really grateful for that.
How challenging was that to do? Just given that you were either in your second or third trimester of pregnancy, what did you have to keep in mind? What did you have to watch out for?
I always say I wore a front pack and a backpack, you know, so I was very conscious about limiting my weight of my gear because I was carrying the extra weight of just being pregnant. And I always wanted to make sure that I was well fueled and well hydrated, even more than usual. But the difficulty was just physical, like there was some discomfort. But in a lot of ways, it was interesting, like even the hip belt from the pack seemed to really like support my pregnant belly. So again, more weight, a little discomfort, you know, some female hygiene things going on. But emotionally, like the weight that was lifted when I was outdoors, that was what was so striking. It's like, okay, I'm walking down the trail probably with the heaviest weight I'll ever have because I may be 20 pounds, 30 pounds heavier than I usually am with all my gear still on my back. But again, it goes back to this idea of like when I was on the trail, I struggled off trail through pregnancy with this like anxiety and insecurities and depression and just feeling really in a dark place. And when I went out on the trail, that was alleviated. It was like a break from that. So it was totally worth, and this is the thing, backpacking is challenging, but the challenge is worth the result and the experience. And it was just even more so during pregnancy.
We should also mention that you walked across the state of North Carolina while nursing your son and set foot on a trail in all 50 states with your daughter.
Yes. And I'm so grateful for you actually mentioning those things because I think after I set the record on the Appalachian Trail, the way our culture and our society is sort of set up, we really look at records and people who are number one. And that story gets a lot of attention. But these journeys as a mother have been so important for me and for my family. And just as difficult in a lot of ways, walking across North Carolina I was doing it in support of this trail called the Mountains to Sea Trail and in support of conservation across the state. And I had work engagements, and my job was to hike 1,200 miles and lead trips and give talks. And then, oh yeah, I had this 10-month-old who my husband was caring for during the day, but then I was still nursing in the mornings and then the evenings, and we would all try to camp out as a family. And it was extremely trying and it was extremely difficult. But being outdoors in that experience, again, has changed my life in so many positive ways. And we want to do everything we can to protect and promote trails and encourage conservation and encourage other people to get outdoors. And so much of this for me when I got started is I didn't see a lot of single women doing it. Or then I remember actually encountering a woman backpacking the Colorado Trail when she was about 6 months pregnant. And I thought, oh, like this is possible. And so a lot of this is showing other people and women and mothers that it is possible to go outdoors and use your body and be healthy during these stages of life. And the trail can meet you at every stage of life.
And this brings us back to what you were talking about before, and that is Blue Ridge Hiking Company.
Yes. So Blue Ridge Hiking Company is another one of my babies. But that's the business baby. I started the hiking company when I was 24, and partly because I, you know, again, got out and had this experience outdoors and was like, oh my gosh, like, oh, high school would have been so much better if I just like learned some of these lessons on the trail. Or I remember this one moment I had hiking on the Appalachian Trail, and I got to a mountain actually on the border of North Carolina and Tennessee. It's called Roan Mountain, and there's this part called Big Hump, and it's just this incredible view, and the sun was going down and no one else was around. And it was the first time in my life I realized that I was a part of everything that I could see, and I was a part of nature, and it just made me feel beautiful and capable and a little bit wild. And like that feeling, I was like, oh, I just want to give people that feeling. And I think there's a lot of hurdles that prevent people from going outside. And on my first hike on the AT, I was like, well, I think there aren't more women out here because of concerns over safety or because knowledge, they weren't taught how to be outdoors, or because of logistics, they're not sure what weight to bring. Or in the past, gear has been really heavy and that's been a barrier to entry. And so I was like, if I can address these issues through Blue Ridge Hiking Company, then I can make the trail more accessible. And so that's what we really do. We try to help people to feel safe through knowledge and by doing group settings, taking people out on group backpacking trips, group day hikes, or individual if they want, teaching them what to do, taking care of the logistics. We have all lightweight gear, which makes it more feasible for people to hike and backpack on the trail. And this past year, I mean, our numbers go up every year, but this past year, I think we got about 1,500 people out on hikes and backpacking trips, and that is so rewarding for me at the end of the day.
And what was it like to work with Alan Shuptrine on the book, the coffee table book?
Alan is awesome, and his wife, Bonnie. They're really a team, and even their gallery manager, Rochelle. They are very motivated, hardworking artists, and I've been an author for about a decade now, and I've partnered with artists, and all the things you hear sometimes about an artist is that, oh, they're so creative, but sometimes disorganized, or they have trouble finishing projects on time. And Alan is this really rare animal, I think, he and his team, where he gets a vision in mind, and he's so talented, and he's so artistic, and goes into the land of creativity and produces this thing that's really magical and beautiful and inspiring, but he does it in a very like professional way, which has just not been my experience in the past with artists. And so it was like such a joy to like channel all this creativity and passion and do it in a way that was very like driven. And we had marks and we had timelines that we wanted to meet together. And there was a lot of synergy there and not a lot of micromanaging. I will say that like they were also great to work with because Alan is the artist and he wanted to capture Appalachia in his own way and through his watercolors and through his paints. And he said, you are going to do it through your words and through your prose and whatever feels right to you, that's what's going to be in the book. And so the fact that we were given a lot of freedom and those freedoms work together so well, and that ties back to this idea that for me, outdoors, being outdoors, hiking has always felt liberating. It was a project that truly expressed that in tandem, which was awesome.
How do you go about writing what you see?
Well, I've done it in a lot of different ways at this point. I come from a place, the coffee table book I did with Alan is actually my 9th book. And one of the most rewarding as a writer, because it was the first time, part of the book is this poetic prose about the history of Appalachia, and part of it's allegorical. And I've pretty much been nonfiction up until this point. So it was really, again, coming back to this word of freeing, to write about the Appalachians in a way that was a bit more loosely connected or figurative. And I used this concept, I don't want to give it totally away, but there's this wise ancient matriarch that represents the mountains. And it's all about this representation and this relationship with the matriarch and what she's able to teach and convey and share through time together. So that is the essence of the book. But before that, some of my writing has been very technical and guidebook oriented, and some of it's been a very detailed description of the external experience of hiking. My first book, Becoming Odessa, if you want to find out what it's like to have a very traditional 5-month hike on the Appalachian Trail, there's a lot of description about the place and the people and the gear and the experience. But then I have a book titled Called Again, which is about our record, and it's such an introspective journey of being outdoors and trying to find your limits and your best in connection with being outdoors. So I always say I can sum up all the books in about 2 words, and it's like, go outside. But we've done it now in a lot of like really different ways, which has been cool.
And we should mention that you are coming here to Chattanooga next year to Baylor School.
Yeah, I've had a connection with Baylor now for quite a while. They have had me over to speak to their high school group, and then I've also worked with their seniors. They do a senior retreat in the Southern Appalachians, and so I've spoken to them there. And so it's a great place and a great school, and I was also fortunate enough to be able to work with GPS and also Macaulay last spring. So I love, I mean, for me, again, like, I'm all about getting people outdoors, and to get to go and work with students in middle school or high school, it's such a great age group for, and there's such a need to hear that message. And as a speaker, as someone who's going and sharing her stories with this age group, I just really love it because they're old enough to totally understand it, and they're young enough to make a difference that'll last the rest of their life and implement. So yeah, I'm really fortunate to work with some of those great organizations and schools in Chattanooga.
And in the meantime, how can we follow you online?
Oh, online, Jennifer Farr Davis. You can look up my website, or Blue Ridge Hiking Company is the hiking company website. And then I'm on social media. Facebook is Jennifer Farr Davis, or Jen, J-E-N, Farr, P-H-A-R-R, Davis, D-A-V-I-S, on Instagram. And if you come over the mountains to the eastern side of the Appalachians, we hope you visit us. We have a shop in downtown Asheville and even a bunkhouse on the Appalachian Trail in Hot Springs. So we'll see you down the trail.
All right. Jennifer, thanks so much and all the best.
Thanks to you. Have a great day.
You're listening to Scenic Roots on WUTC. I'm Ray Bassett. Thanks for listening to Scenic Roots. Our show is produced by Haley Solomon, Carly Dodson, and Will Davis from the studios of WUTC at the University of Tennessee at Chattanooga. Follow us on Twitter at ScenicRoots423 and email us at ScenicRoots423@gmail.com. Also, follow WUTC on Facebook and Instagram, and listen online anytime at WUTC.org and the WUTC app. Join us again next time for Scenic Roots.